Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. What if there's a place where people aren't constantly scrolling on cell phones, where forest hikes are never tainted by ringtones or one-way conversations, where getting lost means really getting lost because, you know what, your GPS isn't going to work here? Well, these questions led my guest through rugged Appalachian backcountry and into the heart of the Quiet Zone. It's a corner of America that's unique for its electromagnetic silence. It's also known for its neo-Nazis, unsolved murders, and electrosensitives. It's a fascinating story that we're going to share today. The book is called The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence. And my guest is Stephen Kersey. He's an award-winning journalist. His works appeared in the New York Times, The New Yorker, and the Christian Science Monitor, amongst others. He graduated from the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. And this is Stephen's first book, but I know for sure it's not going to be his last. I really enjoyed the entire book. It's called, again, The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence. And here's my guest, Stephen Kersey. Stephen Kersey, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Vicki.
I'm so excited to have you because I've seen several documentary films on this subject and it's always fascinated me. So I was really interested to read about your immersion in this place called The Quiet Zone. So I think we should begin with what we mean by The Quiet Zone and where it is in West Virginia so that people understand what we're talking about from the get-go. I'll leave that to you.
So there's a bit of a confusion about what it means like to be in the Quiet Zone, because there's actually a couple of quiet zones when we talk about the Quiet Zone. I'll start from the beginning, which was back in the 50s, the National Science Foundation decided it wanted to make a big investment in the science of radio astronomy, which is sort of a burgeoning science. It measures radio waves coming in from the universe, as opposed to optical astronomy, which essentially measures light waves coming in from the universe. Radio waves, just like light waves, allow us to see what's happening out there, to make different kinds of discoveries and understand how the universe works. But you can only do radio science, radio astronomy, if you're in a really quiet area where you don't have interference from surrounding radio static. And so back in the 50s, a search was done of the entire eastern United States for the quietest suitable place for this radio astronomy observatory, the very first in the United States, the very first federal astronomy observatory. And Green Bank, West Virginia, was determined to be the quietest place. And then it was naturally quiet because it's remote. It's right. Surrounded by mountains. There's not many people. There's not much industry. And then a couple of laws were passed, essentially, to keep it quiet. So in 1956, the West Virginia legislature passed the West Virginia Radio Astronomy Zoning Act, which essentially mandated that within 10 miles of this observatory, that's here in Green Bank, where I am now, actually, it would be illegal to emit any electronic interference that would interfere with those telescopes. And then 2 years later, the U.S. Congress passed a national radio quiet zone. And this is 13,000 square miles. For context, that's the size of Connecticut and Massachusetts combined. And so 13,000 square miles where all kinds of like land-based wireless communications, cell service, two-way radio, ham radio, it all has to be approved before it gets installed by the Quiet Zone Administrator here in Green Bank. So there's two quiet zones. There's like the really big quiet zone, but there's also the really quiet zone in that 10-mile radius in the center around Green Bank.
Okay. And so what data are they gathering there at this center?
So radio waves, just kind of like light waves, it's a form of electromagnetic radiation. And with a telescope, it kind of functions similar to a radio antenna on your car. You can't see those waves, but it's picking them up. And with a receiver and with an amplifier, you can essentially listen to those sounds of deep space. So many discoveries have happened in Green Bank using these telescopes over the years. pulsars. The very first pulsar in a supernova was discovered here. Data that clued us into the age of the universe. And other kinds of discoveries in geodesy and navigation and data researching technology. On a whole another level, Green Bank is actually the site of the world's very first official search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And that's a search that's still going on to this day. For the past half century, essentially, the telescopes here in Green Bank have been scanning the skies and keeping a lookout for that potential call from ET, if there's a intelligent, you know, life forms out there that might be trying to communicate with us here on Earth.
Mm. Now, you write in the book that, in a sense, your journey to the Quiet Zone began in 2009, and going there was something of a pilgrimage for you. So tell us why you wanted to go there and what it meant to you when you took that first trip.
Back in 2009, I threw away my cell phone, and I've never gotten a new one. Initially, I was traveling internationally. It wasn't going to work as I kind of popped from country to country. And I also wanted to save some money when I got back to the United States. I didn't want to, you know, spend a couple hundred dollars on an iPhone and lock myself into a data plan for 1 or 2 years like Apple or whatever Android service was telling me that I would have to do if I wanted to get a smartphone
right,
or something.
Right.
And I also kind of wanted to, like, run this experiment on myself just to see, oh, well, everybody else has a cell phone. What's it going to be like if I don't? And that kind of initially trivial decision morphed into this obstinate refusal, really, to get a device that everybody around me was telling me I had to get. And it also into kind of like an ideological opposal to being constantly connected. There's been so much research that's come out in the past decade showing how smartphones like erode our ability to have interpersonal relationships, concentrate, and be in the moment. Smartphones have been shown to have like negative effects on schools and test scores, and some psychologists have even said that like the current generation of kids is going through the worst health crisis known in recent decades because of smartphones and this always connected lifestyle that is just being pushed on us. So at some point, I think it was 2017, I just started thinking, where does somebody like me get along? Like, are there any other people like me out there who also don't have smartphones or cell phones and who maybe share my philosophical aversion to being always connected? And I did a search online for places without cell service. And the first thing that popped up was Green Bank, West Virginia, supposedly the quietest town in America because of the observatory and those quiet regulations that we spoke about a second ago. And within weeks, I was here. I dove into West Virginia with my then girlfriend Jenna, who's now my wife, and we have a couple kids. It was March of 2017, and right away I was just beguiled by this place. It's deep in Appalachia, in the mountains. It's surrounded by a mix of, you know, fields and beautiful houses, and also trailers, and you know, it's very rural America feeling with ghost towns and some very small pockets of life. And then amid all that, you just have this 485-foot tall tangle of white beams holding up this 2.3-acre dish, which is, you know, big enough to hold 2 football fields. It's just pointing there up in the sky. It seems so incongruous with the landscape that it was fascinating to me, like, why here? And what does it mean to live in a quiet zone? What does it mean to live in Appalachia when you have this astronomy observatory in your backyard? And over the next 3 years, I kept on coming back to this place and spent a total of about 4 months here over the past 4 years.
And so at what point did you decide you wanted to write a book, Stephen? I mean, it's one thing to go visit or write an article, but what point did the book come to you?
I would say right away.
Well, there's certainly plenty of material, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, so the book definitely morphed over time, though. So, like, I was already kind of on the hunt for, like, a book idea. I was thinking, oh, you know, so I was actually, when I first visited here, I was doing a journalism fellowship at Columbia University, and I was taking this book writing seminar where it kind of, like, walked you through the steps of how to, you know, get your book idea into an actual, like, book proposal. And initially, I was thinking, oh, I just want to write about living without a cell phone myself. originally about the book idea, it morphed into, well, are there other people out there? Is there a real place where people still live this way? And let's go into this place and see what it's actually like there. And as soon as I visited, there was just, right away, it was clear that there's a lot of characters here and a lot more to the story than was previously being reported. There's been a lot of media out about Green Bank and the Quiet Zone already, like you mentioned, seeing some documentaries and news spots. But it didn't seem like anyone was really going real deep. It was like, you know, a quick visit or, you know, even just a telephone interview, but nobody really staying here for a while.
Right.
And so I kept on coming back, and honestly, as I kept coming back, the story kept on shifting. Like, rather than focusing just on Green Bank, I started going out into the community and meeting this real culture, quirky culture around here, which is kind of bubbled up because of it being quiet. There's all these groups and people here that have been attracted to the quiet over the past half century since it became a quiet zone, and that became more of the story over time.
Well, there's certainly a great cast of characters. Before we dive into that, I just want to bust some of those facts versus myths, right? Because there are things written about this, and many of them make this kind of sound an idyllic place, and you say it's a little bit more complicated than that. So people don't have, they actually do have cell phones, but no service. They can have internet, but no Wi-Fi. In some cases, electric blankets have been replaced by the observatory because they were making too much noise. What are some of those myths that we hear that just aren't true?
Well, the Wi-Fi one is a big one. You can just Google, you know, news articles for Green Bank and the Quiet Zone, and you'll see many headlines from the New York Times to CNN to National Public Radio, which basically say, welcome to a place with no cell phones, no cell service, no Wi-Fi, and everybody's happy for it to be that way. There is cell service within about 9 miles of Green Bank. There's cell service that dots around the Quiet Zone, even around the county. So there is like some degree of cell phone service. It's not directly in Green Bank. There are absolutely smartphones and cell phones throughout the Green Bank area. I was just having lunch with a family who live like right next to the telescopes, and they have smartphones. They live right there. And they also have Wi-Fi. And like I said, their property abuts the observatory. Like the Green Bank telescope, that really big one there, it basically looms over their backyard. So they do have Wi-Fi around here. They do have smartphones. And that's not a new thing. I think it was back in... So you can get a sense exactly for how many people around the town have these gadgets, have Wi-Fi or whatever, because the observatory has somebody who's known as like the Quiet Zone Cop, and he drives around in this electromagnetic interference tracking truck and has all these antennas sticking out of the top, and they act as like a direction-finding array that allows him to track down sources of renegade radio frequency interference. I think even back in 2011 or so, they were picking up 75 Wi-Fi hotspots in the Green Bank area within 2 miles of the observatory. And at this point, at last count, I was told it was 175 Wi-Fi hotspots within 2 miles of the telescopes. So that's a big one that people here really chafe at when they keep on seeing the media, that it's a totally quiet zone where people are living some off-grid lifestyle. There's a woman who lives in Green Bank. She's also a teacher at the local high school. She's like, everybody makes it seem like we're living off the grid and we're living some bohemian lifestyle. I've got a microwave. I've got Wi-Fi. I've got a smartphone. But I don't have cell service. But even on Wi-Fi, I can still use my smartphone. It's becoming less and less of a quiet zone here.
Interesting. And talking of microwaves, I was interested to read in the book that they could actually brown meat, but they don't because they have to comply with the electronic magnetic noise regulations.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
So
there's like these charts you can look at, and it shows the entire electromagnetic spectrum and what bands of it are reserved for various things, commercial purposes versus, you know, radio astronomy versus military. And you can just Google it, and you'll see the chart, and you'll see some bands, and they're just, it's like 10.6 something or whatever, and that's reserved for radio astronomy. I think that was the band where microwave manufacturers could potentially have browned meat rather than it just being kind of like cooked from the inside out and turning into this goo or whatever, you know, sometimes. Microwaves actually operate in the 2.4 gigahertz frequency. It's the same frequency
Interesting.
They're both problematic for the observatory, but you can imagine like a microwave, it's only on for, 30 seconds, a minute at a time, mm-hmm. and any frequency, any leakage from that is just going to be for a second when you open and close the door or whatever. But Wi-Fi is something that's always on, it's always emitting, and so it's really made that 2.4 gigahertz frequency polluted in the Green Bank area. It's made it really hard for the astronomers to do any kind of like observations with the telescopes in that frequency band.
Hmm. Well, what makes any story really, really interesting is the characters, and you certainly have an array of those in the book. Were you expecting to find that when you went out there? I mean, everybody from hippies to white supremacists and the electrosensitive people out there, were you expecting that?
No. No, in short. I had heard a bit about the electrosensitives because there's been a lot written about them, but I wasn't expecting the electrosensitives to be quite as eccentric as I found them to be. And then when I got here, I started hearing about this nearby NSA, National Security Agency, spy facility, which is also very much for the sake of the Quiet Zone. I heard about these backslanders and hippies, most notable among them being Patch Adams, who was kind of made famous by that movie starring Robin Williams.
Yes, yeah.
And then that neo-Nazis were in the county, and they've been attracted to the Quiet. And not just any group of white supremacists, this is the most well-organized and dangerous neo-Nazi formation in America for several decades. It was led by William Luther Pierce, who wrote a kind of infamous book of neo-Nazi racist futurism called The Turner Diaries, which has been linked to numerous incidences of deadly terrorist violence over the past half century, most notably the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. The book was actually found in the car of Timothy McVeigh when he was found driving away from Waco.
Mm-hmm.
And even more nefariously, to show how that neo-Nazi influence has kind of been on the county itself, William Pierce dedicated his second book, Hunter, it's another fictional novel, to a man named Joseph Paul Franklin. He was a racist serial killer who roamed the country, actually killing blacks and Jews and people who were involved in interracial relationships. Two of his victims, alleged victims, he claimed that they were his victims, although there was actually never, there's some debate about if he actually killed them or somebody else did, but two of his alleged victims were actually here in Pocahontas County. It shows you how, like, that William Pierce influence really circled back and it hit the county itself. And then most recently, you have this wave of electrosensitives. And they have this new disease called electromagnetic hypersensitivity, where they believe they can feel Wi-Fi, cell service, other kinds of electromagnetic radiation from modern gadgetry. Not just feel it, but it causes them severe pain. Like, if they would say, if I was to turn on a cell phone or turn on Wi-Fi in their presence, they would know immediately and they would start feeling pain. And hundreds of them have fled here to the Green Bank area over the past 10 years because they believe it's like their last refuge in a noisy world. And so you can imagine they're especially unhappy about the increasing amount of smartphones and Wi-Fi that's in the area.
Right. That's actually where I first heard about the Quiet Zone. I was watching a film about these people who had these weird disorders that no doctor could diagnose, and they came to the conclusion it was electromagnetic sensitivity. And one of them moved out to the Quiet Zone, and I became fascinated with that area after seeing that.
Was that the Netflix documentary,
Afflicted? It could have been that. Yep, it could have been that.
Yeah, there's a character, a real woman, whose name is Carmen in Afflicted, and she comes out here to Green Bank. And yeah. Some of those people who she interacts with are also people who are characters in my book.
Yeah, interesting. And so what for you was the most, I mean, do you have a favorite character that you talk about in the book? I mean, I say character, these are real people, but did you have a favorite connection?
There's a local man named D. Thompson. He lives just maybe a half mile down the dirt road from the neo-Nazi compound where William Pierce lived for several decades. He died in 2002, but his organization is still here in Pocahontas County. And when I first went up to see what was actually going on there. I met Dee's wife, and then a follow-up visit, I met Dee himself. And pretty quickly, we started talking about all the strange people. We started talking about Patch Adams. He had met Patch Adams before and gone skinny dipping with some of Patch Adams' hippie followers over at the Gesundheit Institute. And he had met William Pierce. And he was also very aware of several unsolved murders in the county that became particularly engrossing to me. There was one murder from 1975 where a young man's body was actually found inside of a cave, like, naked and with several bullet holes in his head. And Dee Thompson starts telling me how he's been in the cave before and he'll take me back inside. And the next day I found myself deep inside this cave with Dee Thompson, and in the back of my mind, I'd been reading about the case, and I knew that Dee's father was actually one of the suspects in the killing of this young man, and there was another man involved in it, too, who turned up dead. I was scared out of my mind
for those, imagine,
the 2 hours that I was in the cave with Dee Thompson. But in a funny way, while I'm trying to think of how to phrase this, Dee Thompson was a very endearing person, and in reality, I realized that a lot of my fright or my intimidation from him had to do with perhaps my own stereotypes or my own prejudices against somebody who was a drug dealing ex-convict or somebody who had a bit of a shady past or who happened to live near the neo-Nazis. But in reality, Dee Thompson, he took me into the cave. He gave me an awesome tour of it. He picked up water and fig bars for sustenance while we were, like, on our hands and knees crawling through this cave. It was a really nice moment of connection with somebody, I felt like, in this area. And that's somebody who I'm looking forward to actually catching up with while I'm back here in Pocahontas this week.
Yeah, because you're there right now as we're talking, so that's great. A little out of your comfort zone there. So
yeah.
Go ahead, sorry.
I was going to say, it was this moment of, here I don't have a cell phone, not that it would work anyway, down deep inside a cave inside the earth, and like coming to the quiet zone was kind of this, it was a pilgrimage, like you said, of looking for the quietest place in America, finding somebody else like me who shares my aversion, and here I am inside of a cave. It's like almost the logical conclusion of that search for a quiet place.
Right.
And it's not a place where I wanted to be. It's not a place where anybody wants to be. Like, and it really highlights this idea of how the going down the wormhole into the quiet and just seeing quiet itself as a utopia can kind of turn on itself. And you can see how there's a flip side to that and how we need to find, some kind of healthy balance in our own lives between quiet and the online world.
Yes, you say that disconnecting is not the answer to everything. I am somebody who actually turns my cell phone off, and I get chastised for that occasionally. But, I don't like being connected 24/7. I think it's a tool that it's a great tool, but, when we start becoming obsessed with it, then who's the boss in that situation? So
I totally respect your decision to turn it off. And the thing is, like, for me, one reason I don't have a smartphone is because I don't know if I would have the willpower like you to be able to turn it off. Like, I already know that I abuse being online whenever I'm on Wi-Fi or whenever I can have access to it. And so my decision to not have a smartphone, it's a little bit like an alcoholic not, choosing not to put a beer in their hand or be around it. Like, I just don't want to have that near me because I don't want to be tempted.
Yeah. Well, I've talked with many people about the addiction factor and how, programs and applications, they're designed to get you addicted. And I've talked with neuroscientists about what that does to your brain. And I read in your book that I think it was 259 people actually died while they were taking selfies because presumably they got too near to the edge of something or they fell into something.
I mean, like what is it turning us into, right? We're so obsessed with our devices. We're so keen on getting that perfect selfie on the edge of the cliff that we take the step backward and tumble to our death. Like, it's literally killing us.
Yeah. I love this analogy. You talked a little about marketing professors, Shiri Melamad and Michael Pham, I think it was, and their research paper, Understanding the Psychology, Smartphone Usage, and they called it the Adult Pacifier Hypothesis.
Yeah. It's this idea of, like, you know, just like a pacifier, a baby needs a pacifier to be soothed. It becomes like a hang up, like a need. They just have to have that pacifier to be sucking on. So do many teenagers and adults just need that device at their hand. It becomes something, it doesn't provide sustenance or something really logical that we need. It just becomes something that we instinctively want, like a pacifier.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm guilty of it too. Even though I say I turn mine off, I caught myself scrolling through Twitter the other night and I thought, why am I doing this? It's so banal. But it's there. So this, the quiet zone is also a place that lends itself very well to folklore and conspiracy theories and stuff, and it'd probably be a whole book in itself. But you do write of some of the folklore or myths, if you will, like the Grafton Monster and other legends. Do you have a favorite story there?
I loved hearing all the conspiracies of what people really think is happening at the observatory. And a lot of those conspiracies are fueled by real events. The National Quiet Zone, I mentioned it's 13,000 square miles. It's huge. It encompasses an actual, real-life, secret government bunker that was built to hold 1,200 legislators in the event of a nuclear attack on Washington, D.C. This is secretly built beneath the Greenbrier Luxury Hotel in White Sulphur Springs, to the very southern edge of the National Radio Quiet Zone. Also here, just about 25 miles away, is this secretive National Security Agency facility, which has about a half dozen radio antennas, which are silently sweeping in millions of phone calls and text messages and emails every single hour. Hmm. And the Quiet Zone allows it to do its work. So you really do have that Greenbrier bunker, and you really do have this NSA listening post, and that fuels these conspiracies that they're connected to the observatory in some nefarious way. And that might be the telescopes are actually a cover for an actual NSA facility here in Green Bank, or perhaps the telescopes are a cover for another bunker here, and the Greenbrier was just a ruse. That's why we all know about it, but the real one is here in Green Bank, or maybe it's underneath Sugar Grove. The land around here is also riddled with caves. Some of the largest cave systems in the United States are underneath Pocahontas and neighboring Pendleton County and Greenbrier County. And there's rumors that there's this massive underground cave and tunnel system that links Green Bank and the Greenbrier Hotel and Sugar Grove. That's like this Bermuda Triangle of unknowable government conspiratorial activities.
Mm, interesting. Fascinating stuff. You know, I always read the acknowledgements in books, and have to share this because I was absolutely blown away when I read this, and I thought, surely not. You say that you and your wife, Jen, are now married with two kids. You went old school with the baby wear. You chose not to use diapers that text you when the baby has pooped.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you can find them online. yeah, isn't that amazing? Yeah.
Yeah, I was gobsmacked with that. And then socks that measure baby's heart rate and blood oxygen levels. So I never heard of those either.
Perfect examples of, like, technology just going too far and causing needless anxiety. Because along with that tech that's supposed to, like, provide the baby heartbeat or when the baby poops, it provides false alarms. And so I was reading articles about people getting these heart monitoring socks, and then they would kind of malfunction, and it would say the baby's heart stopped beating. And it would rush up to find the baby who was napping, and it's doing fine. We had like a needless scare because the technology is malfunctioning. It's like a little microcosm of what we do to ourselves by thinking tech is a solution to everything instead of just getting rid of it and simplifying our lives.
Right. And so when you re-enter the world, you know, you went out for these periods of time immersing yourself in the quiet zone. When you re-enter the real world, if you will, what is that like for you?
It was always kind of like going through a wormhole or like a time warp. When I would come back to Green Bank, it was like no time had passed. And that was in a real sense because time move slowly here. It's same people doing the same thing week after week and year after year. That doesn't really seem to change. Over 4 years, I visited the same countryside church, and at the front of the church, on this, you know, on the register of attendance and offering, it said the same exact thing. They just never bothered to update how many people had attended or how much money had been tithed every week. And it was, you know, the sense of like,
right,
things don't change here.
Right.
And then when I would come back out as well, it was a bit of the opposite. It was like I was racing forward into the future. I would kind of be overwhelmed, it almost felt like, with all of a sudden this barrage of news and things happening, especially because I was going from Green Bank to New York City. It's like hyper offline and slow versus hyper connected and super fast paced. And so it can be a bit overwhelming.
Yeah.
Either way, it was like, in either case, I was like either slamming on the brakes when I came to Green Bank or like racing up to speed when I got back to New York City.
Right. And obviously, I mean, you've been a journalist for a long time. You depended on technology for stories and for work. So you're not a Luddite here. But for your kids, you say you want tech to be a choice and not a requisite for living.
Yeah. You know, part of my whole thing with smartphones and cell phones is I kind of think they're necessarily bad for everyone. I recognize that plenty of people have jobs where they absolutely need to have them, like they're required to have them, like say you're working in social media or something where they really do, like if you're an EMT worker or a first responder, of course those devices are really important for those people. I just resent the fact that everybody from, you know, my mother who's a teacher to my father's a minister, they're just required to be online all the time and that you're never given a break, that you go on vacation, you're supposed to, you know, still bring your cell phone with you just in case we have to reach you, or you have to keep your cell phone at hand after 5 p.m. even though, wait, I thought work was supposed to stop at a certain time. Why aren't you not paying me to be online for the rest of the day? I resent the fact that it's a requisite that we all have to have a smartphone and always be available for other people all the time.
Yeah.
And my not having a cell phone, it's a little bit of like a, you know, it's a little bit chaotic. It's a little bit of like, you know, fighting windmills, but it's like the little thing I can do to kind of stick out my elbows and say, no, I don't want to live this way. And I want to make sure that I want to try and fight for my son so that he doesn't necessarily have to live this way either. If he wants to have a cell phone and be always connected, that's his choice. But it should stay his choice. It shouldn't be something that's thrust upon him. It shouldn't all of a sudden be a requirement for being, you know, a functioning citizen or a member of the United States of America.
Right. Well, even trying to find work now that doesn't require you being on a computer is almost impossible. I was trying to help a friend who desperately wanted to make a career change and wanted away from tech, and we couldn't really come up with anything with their set of skills. So,
yeah, it's a little bit of like a problem of our own making to some extent. It's
mm-hmm.
like the economy has been transitioning away from manual labor, right, and outsourcing a lot of that overseas. And now we have jobs where we don't have to quite work as hard, but it requires us to, you know, download our minds onto the hive or be always staring at a screen. Like, we have to, it's like pick your poison almost, right?
Right. Well, Stephen Kersey, pleasure speaking with you. I really, really enjoyed your book, The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence. What did you take away from it? What do you carry with you from this experience of researching and writing this book?
It's a couple of things. One is that we can't expect to find a utopia. We can't expect to find paradise in Green Bank. Green Bank is struggling with this tension between smartphones and Wi-Fi and constant connectivity, just like the rest of the world is. And a lot of articles around this place kind of paint it in this perfect picture, which I think is like this a little bit of like an emotional need to kind of like say, oh, there's one place that still reminds us of what humanity used to be, or what like true humanity maybe is. But even here in Green Bank, they're struggling with those things, and that should be a reminder for all of us that we have to internalize this struggle. We have to pick up the fight and find out like what that balance is going to be with technology in our own lives.
Right.
On another level, personally, I'm intensely aware of being a hypocrite when it comes to my own relationship with technology. Through all these interviews I've been doing, I'm looking at a computer and I'm using Twitter to promote the book, and and I'm online a lot when my son is right next to me trying to play. And I need to do a better job in my own life managing my time online versus offline, and so that I can have that, you know, focused time with my own son to be with him.
Right, right. Well, I know listeners can find out much more about you at your website, stephencursey.com, and the book again, The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence. A final thought you'd like to leave us with today?
A final thought. Green Bank is a beautiful area, and I would recommend everybody to come to Pocahontas County and see it for yourself. You can go on tours around the Green Bank Observatory and see these awesome telescopes and learn more about the history of that alien search that's been happening over the past 50 years here. And the surrounding county, it's gorgeous. 3/5 of the county is state or national forest. It's mountainous. There's skiing and mountain biking and swimming and hiking and everything you could want. Even though there's darker things lurking in the woods here, there's still a lot of brightness and fun to enjoy.
Right, right. It certainly is. I hope I get out there someday. It's a fascinating area. Thank you so much for being with us today, Stephen. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Vicky.
And you can find out much more about us at conversationslive.net. If you have feedback or questions on today's show, you can reach me through the website, conversationslive.net. We'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.